welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. It seems that every six or seven shows, I will say today is a special show. Well, today is one of those very special shows. So unusual with my good friend and ever so creative and bright, insightful, successful entrepreneur, millionaire, Caitlin Kogan Domner. And she admits, so I can say her age, she's 36 years old. She's married. She has a child that's nine, children that are nine, seven, and five. They are taking a 2.5 year adventure expedition around the world. They're doing the United States now. They're headed to Mexico. Then they're going to South America, Antarctica, Asia, Europe, and then determining what they can do. And her goal is to teach her children to become world citizens and to teach them Spanish. It's a brilliant time before they get into adolescence and they have friends. They can experience life in the universe, or in the universe, in the world. And we also then, we spend our first half of our session on that. And then we talk about Caitlin's brilliant ideas about being an optimist or an opportunist. And she talks much about how to be an opportunist, how to recognize events in your life, how to influence, not so much control, but influence, and then submit and surrender to the divine while at the same time being very active. This is a brilliant, brilliant conversation. Caitlin is amazing. Please, please enjoy Caitlin Kogan with Charlie Hedges on the next chapter with Charlie. Caitlin Domner, how fun to have you on the show again, especially since you are just in the early stages of a world tour with what I'm calling your family of modern day gypsies.
Yes, we are about 6 weeks in, and we are here in Florida today. So I'm so glad that I get to be here with you, Charlie.
Oh, I have to hear about this because, you know, I've been debating on whether to begin this because there's two aspects to the show. And I've been debating on whether to begin with the gypsy journey or finish with the gypsy journey. And I guess since it's my decision and the ball is in my court, I'm opting for the gypsy journey first. And then we'll move on to your keen insights as to living either as an optimist or an opportunist. Both are such a delight. So let's begin with Caitlin. What in the world are you up to that you've been only recently involved in 6 weeks? Now, 6 weeks sounds like a long vacation to some people. We're going to find out it's not for you.
No, we keep reminding ourselves we're not on vacation. It's really hard because this road trip across the U.S., we've done Yellowstone, we've done Mount Rushmore, St. Louis Arch, Nashville, Asheville, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia. We're now in St. Augustine, the oldest city in the United States, founded in 1565, we discovered today, on our historical journey. But this is just the prelude. We're doing a round-the-world adventure for about 2.5 years. The plan is to hit all seven continents, about 62 countries, with our three small kids. We have Cora, Jackson, and Bradley, who are 9, 7, and 5, respectively.
Do you know what you just did to me right there? You just sent me into a ball of convulsion saying, oh, no, I couldn't possibly do that. I have to ask, so you can just tell me decades, but what decade are you in personally that you're doing this?
Oh, I don't mind. I'm 36, so the middle of the fourth decade.
Okay, so 36 years old. When did you decide? I know you've been talking about this for well over a year at least. What's the genesis of this, and what's the purpose, and what's going on? Tell us all about it.
Yeah, there's so many layers. We've been actively planning for about 2.5 years. So I've been an entrepreneur for about 10 years, and we decided, my husband and I decided about 2.5 years ago, that we wanted to do some pretty extensive travel. So his son, Nathan, is 18. He graduated from high school last year from his previous marriage. And so we knew we wanted to stay in Southern California until he graduated. And our youngest, we wanted him to be out of diapers, able to read, able to have some memories. So we knew the timeline. We just didn't know what it looked like. So at first, it sounded like spending a year through Mexico. And then we decided, well, if we're just going to drive through Mexico, we might as well just drive through South America. And then we said, well, if we're going through all the way through South America, why would we stop there? Why wouldn't we just keep going? And so it just sort of ballooned. And then the two-year time frame came because Cora will be going into sixth grade. Now, that's gotten a little flexible as I've become more okay with the idea of homeschooling. So we may or may not be back with a firm deadline, but at least 2 years is the plan. And we knew that wherever we ended up, because we weren't going to stay in California, wherever we ended up was going to be our forever home. And I've had this wanderlust in me for as long as I can remember. I'm always looking at externally, where do I want to go? What do I want to see? What do I want to do? And so I wanted to get that out of my system. And so one of the things that we're doing, one of the reasons we went to Asheville, North Carolina, one of the reasons we're going to be spending 4 weeks in Chile, is that we're also looking for where we want that forever home to be. So we're going to scout the world for the place that we consider a little heaven on earth. So this is partly to just kind of get that out of our system, partly to just build some incredible memories and have some really quality time with the kids. So the last 10 years that I've been building my business, I've been go, go, go. And they've been pretty young. And I realized, you know, by the time they get into junior high, they're going to have their own interests. They're going to want to be in sports. They're going to have friendships that they don't want to leave. It's going to be really hard to pick up our entire family and turn mm-hmm. them into nomads mm-hmm. after they're in adolescent years. And so this really just seemed like that sweet spot. We had planned it even before COVID hit. Thankfully, COVID doesn't seem to be disrupting it too much. Most countries are beginning to open up. We did get our vaccinations, and we're just going to kind of go wherever people will let us go at this point. So it's a pretty fluid itinerary. We know, generally speaking, it's going to take us about 4 to 6 months to get down to the tip of South America. We have our Antarctica cruise booked. It was the first thing we booked because we knew that was going to be the hardest, and we had to plan around that. So December 9th, we go on a two-week cruise down to Antarctica, and then we head west. So we'll see if New Zealand or Australia are allowing tourists by that point, and then head up through Asia, quick stop into Africa, through Europe, and then we'll head home after that.
Well, you know what's really striking me is that you've given me an itinerary and sort of tactics. I'm curious about the rationale, other than your natural curiosity, your archetype of adventure and explorer that, you know, mm-hmm. that I have also. And so I'm always interested by that. But as a family, what is the rationale? What do you hope to accomplish? Forgive me, I wanted your husband's first name. I want to say Michael, is that right?
Michael, yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. So what did you and Michael think would be good for the two of you and good for your three young children? What was the driving force? What made you think this would be good for our family as opposed to being stuck in whatever land you're stuck in?
Right. And, you know, you could ask me this question 10 different times, and I'm pretty sure I would have a different answer each time because there are just so many layers to this. So I think on one of our last conversations, I mentioned that I have this sort of morbid fascination with the end of the world. And as I was looking ahead at climate change, and this was even before COVID, I knew that the world was going to look different for our kids and our grandkids than it does now. And I realized there was a very good chance that my grandkids won't be able to go to an open air fish market in the middle of a country and just buy seafood the way we just did in Washington, D.C. And my middle son, Jackson, is pretty serious about becoming an astronaut. He wants to be the first person to Mars. I told him he probably won't be the first person, but there's a good chance that, you know, he could be off planet as a career choice. And I had this idea of, like, wanting to give my kids an experience of Earth. This, I really think that we are in a unique kind of golden age where the world is beautiful and there's so much that's easy, right? We get to work virtually. There's internet almost anywhere across the globe. But we haven't overcome what I think are going to be some of the biggest challenges that are still coming at us. It really felt like a perfect opportunity to give them a sense of they are a citizen of an entire planet. We talked about the world getting smaller through technology, and I absolutely think that's true. And I want them to think of themselves as global citizens, that they have a responsibility to the environment. They have a responsibility to their other human beings around the world. There's a lot of fear that seems to be perpetuated these days. And I want to teach them that they don't have to be afraid, that wherever they go, they are going to find people just like them. And it's so funny because I was just talking with my uncle and he was bringing up all of these horror stories. He's convinced my kids are going to get kidnapped, that I'm going to be sold into the sex trade, that he, like, it was just like every worst case scenario you could think of. Now, admittedly, he was a soldier in the Vietnam War. He did see the worst of what we would call travel and what other people have to offer. But every time I've gone to a different country, I have come back changed. Like, my view has expanded. My perspective has changed. My appreciation for nature and humanity has deepened. And I wanted to give my kids a chance to experience that. Even in, for Bradley, it's going to be even in his kind of very formative years. They say that before you're 7 years old, your brain is still in an almost theta state where you're just taking everything in with no judgments, no preconceptions. And I realized that this will be Bradley's normal. And that's an interesting experiment, I guess, that I'm putting my youngest son through. But I really think that's what I want. I want my kids to think big and understand. And we've really come up with kind of four guiding virtues as we're finding experiences and raising the kids, because it's going to be hard to do things like traditional school and sports and those sorts of things that we usually do to enrich children. And so for me, we decided if we can raise kids who are curious, creative, compassionate, and courageous. So the four C's for us are always what we're looking for. So how can we
instill
curiosity, creativity, compassion, and courage in our kids?
I love it. That is brilliant. So there's a sense in which there's integrative objectives in that you have the objective as the curiosity adventurer. You want to find out about life. You want to learn about life. You want to grow. You want to improve. Integrated with that and directly correlated with that is the education of your children to be world citizens, to understand that there is life apart from the American dream that I believe in, but there's so much more for the world to offer. And, you know, you're preaching to the choir, because I'm not really sure, Caitlin, but, you know, it's not a lot, but I probably visited 25 to 30 countries, but it is just so enlightened me about worldview and how people think differently than we do. The rest of the world is thinking just like we are, and they are not. Mm-hmm. They have a solid rationale behind not believing as we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so wonderful that you want to expose your children to that. What about languages? Mm-hmm. Are there any specific languages you want to try to teach them, or are you just going to give them bits and pieces of languages as you go along?
Yeah, so Spanish is going to be the primary. We've sort of begun little words here and there, but once we get to Mexico, the goal is to give them a crash course and see how much we can learn in the 4 or 5 months that we're heading south. And we won't have an interpreter. It's just going to be us learning how to speak and using Babbel or Rosetta Stone, or we've got all of them on our phone. We'll see which one the kids.
Yeah, I've got another guy that I can give to you that's really, really good. So remind
fantastic.
Me. Benny something, but he's maybe the best at it. So at least he's a really good one. He would be worthy of you taking a look at.
Absolutely. If there's ways we can speed learn languages, we're going to
What he's all about. And he's all about, if you can't immerse, then he sets you up with conversations with people in other countries.
Very cool.
And then Spanish, as you say, Spanish, you know, it really is probably the second universal language to English, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Mandarins up there, but simply
because they've got 7 billion people or whatever they've got.
Yeah. So we'll kind of pick up as much as we can. I want them to have at least the courtesy expressions in each country that we go through so that they can, you know, be polite wherever they go.
Yeah. And if they go a step beyond that and they begin to not only translate, but think in another language, if they can get it to a point they think, that broadens your perspective, because Wittgenstein, the great philologist and, you know, known by many as the finest philosopher of the 20th century, says that thought is not a vehicle to communicate what's going on in our mind. Words are the very, very basis of our philosophy. Mm-hmm. That words determine not what we think, but how we think. And
yeah.
I think that's really important. And if you can get your children to do that, much of your goals will be accomplished. Also in this, before we move on, I'm really curious of your books, and especially the first book you want to write. I mean, you are such an aggressive, you're going to get things done. So I call them GSDs. You get shit done.
Yes. My nickname in college was the juggernaut. So that's been a trend for me.
So tell me about your children's adventure book. It is so interesting.
So we knew that we wanted to publish, because I am a writer, we wanted to publish stuff that got kids excited about travel and geography and history and culture and all these things that we want to instill in our own kids. And so at first it was just like, well, we can publish an atlas. We're like, I don't know that our kids would read an atlas. And so then we were like, well, what if we did novels? And so we have finished the draft. It's at the editors right now. The goal is to get it published here, self-published here in the next couple of months. The idea is that it's a fictionalized version of our family. So in the books, I'm an art historian, my husband's an archaeologist, and we travel around the world authenticating art and artifacts. And while we're in these different locations, our kids, Cora, Jackson, and Bradley, who are slightly older in the books, like 12, 10, and 6, they stumble upon a mystery or a crime, and they have to solve it. And the process of solving it takes them through the city, the first one set in Paris, and they have to learn the history and the culture and the language. There's a bigger arc that goes, there's about a 6-book series that we'll be publishing here at the first go. That's the story as I saw it. But yeah, we start in Paris. Book 2 will be set in Guatemala, so it'll be Mystery of the Mayan Mask. We'll get to learn about Mayan culture. Then we
love the Mayans.
Yes, I know. I'm so excited to do that one. And then we cross over to Japan. So we do one that's set in Kyoto, Japan. We get to talk about Chinese and Japanese cultures. And then there'll be a Middle Eastern stone. I haven't decided where, probably Dubai, one in Egypt and one in Greece. Actually, Venice. There's these like magical stones that they're hunting across the globe. They get pulled into a kind of divine conspiracy. So it takes them to all these different locations. But yeah, so the goal is to do the novels so that kids just kind of get sucked into that, and then probably a curriculum for each location. And if you sign up, I want to give out passports so that they can get stickers when they complete the curriculum or read the books, or I don't know, something like that. But we're in the process of launching that. Our brand is all over the map family. So it'll probably be published under that kind of title, or World Mystery Academy. We're kind of playing with the different titles right now. But yeah, the goal is to get a couple of those published here in the fall over Christmas break and into the spring. And yeah, well, that's,
you do know that's I want copies, so put me on your list.
And I will totally send you a copy.
And Caitlin, this is so brilliant. I really can see publishers picking this up, and that you could get a lot of traction
around it. I would like that. Yeah, that's the goal.
It's such a creative idea.
Yeah, they want to see that you have a following. They want to see that the books have been successful. And
these days, they want you to do your own marketing. They're too lazy to do marketing. They don't know how to do it. They want their authors to
market. Unfortunately, that's sort of what I've been specializing in for the last 10 years. So it's just different selling a book than it is selling coaching services. I'm hoping that I can figure out how to market the book.
let's close this part of the discussion. How the world are you going to pay for this? 2.5 years, are you quitting working?
No, no. So I have my two businesses that I can run virtually. I did a flurry of hiring. I've got a CEO for one company and a COO for the other, and they're doing a fantastic job of running the day-to-day operations. And then my husband is launching a hedge fund. So he's been trading for us very successfully for the past 5 years. And now he and his business partner are launching an incubator fund for about a year and a half, and then they'll take it public. He's been very successful trading options. So, yeah, we both have our jobs and businesses, and we're kind of doing them piecemeal. So an hour of work here, an hour of work there. But we make sure we have Wi-Fi wherever we go, because that's critical for all of our work.
And right now, you're living in a minivan with two of, well, not living in, you're traveling in.
We're not living in.
I cannot see you living in a minivan with five people.
Yeah, we're homeless, but we're not that kind of homeless.
Hotel homeless.
Yeah, so we've been doing a lot of Airbnbs. We have like a four-bedroom home right in Magnolia Avenue in St. Augustine. So yeah, you can find some really beautiful places on Airbnb.
Oh, I just see so much coming from this. I mean, I see so much value for your family. I see so much value for your children, mm-hmm. the creativity, the fun that you and Mike are going to have. And then I just see some applications, some truly unique and challenging mm-hmm. applications to people in that want to go to university and want to go to the business world. And it just, in my mind, there are a few things more worthless than university educations. I just talked to an educator, and he's in Spain, and they have a very creative executive plan. They have a small university that has about, but it's small, it's 10,000 people that attend their university, but it's 80% mm-hmm. are foreign. They're in Madrid, mm-hmm. but 80% of the students are foreign business leaders. And mm-hmm. he's very creative, and so he totally agreed with me, and we got, you know, just that we need to reshape, reform, rethink education in general.
Yeah.
So you know what I want to do now, because we're going to go to a whole other topic, and I don't know if it's early or late or not, but Paul, I think we need to take a break before we go to our next section, and then it's very clean. So bear with me for a couple of minutes, okay?
Right.
Hi, this is Charlie Hedges with The Next Chapter with Charlie, and today I am having a most interesting conversation with Caitlin Kogan-Domner about, we just talked about her and her family of modern-day gypsies. She and her husband with children 9, 7, and 5, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, how about that memory? 9, 7, and 5, and they are on a 2.5-year world journey, just completing the United States now, headed to Mexico, South America, Antarctica, over to Asia, over to Europe, and it's all about educating, it's about satisfying her curiosity for the world and educating her children to be world citizens. And to have, before we have even more restrictions, to find the wonder of the world. It's just so brilliant. Now, we are going to make a totally different transition. And Caitlin wrote a Facebook post, and I thought I had my Facebook note letter. Oh, I do. I have two documents, which is really difficult to try to do a podcast off two documents. You know the old story of if you have one watch, you always know what time it is. If you have two, you're never sure. And I'm going to try to stay with one. And you mentioned in this very short post, but I think it was just incredibly powerful. I do not read Facebook. I just get a couple people that say they did a post, and every time Caitlin does a post, I read your post because you're such a fine writer and such a creative thinker. And in this post, as I said, we're making a major transition, but it will come together, and you can see how the two really fit. And you talk in this post about your ideas regarding the label so many people put on you, that people view you or label you as an optimist, and you didn't necessarily resonate with that idea of being an optimist. Do you want to talk to me about what you see as an optimist?
Yeah, I was thinking about this in light of, I mentioned my uncle who was telling me everything that could go wrong. And my brain is just not wired that way. My brain has always been wired to see opportunities. And as I was looking at this adventure, I saw all of the wonderful things that could happen, all of the amazing things. Now, I have learned how to do worst case analysis and SWOT analyses and figure out where the threats and weaknesses are and to accommodate those with strategic planning. But the biggest thing is this term optimist tends to have this kind of naivete that's associated with it, that you think everything's just going to be sunshine and roses. And then there's the other side of people who only, they're the pessimist, right? They see the worst of the world and everything that could go wrong. And I realized both people are looking at the world and assuming that it's those external circumstances that are going to determine whether or not they're successful. So an optimist is looking out and saying, everything's going to work out for me. And a pessimist is looking out and saying, nothing's going to work out for me. And I realized, you know what, what really gives me the confidence do crazy stuff like pick up my family and travel the world or start businesses or publish books is really this focus on what I can control. So I look at the internal of what part of this dynamic can I influence? And if I can't influence it, then why would I worry about it? And so the term I came up with is opportunist, which has its own associations and connotations. But for me, I really think if you're just looking for opportunities, usually they look like problems, right? As an entrepreneur, your job is to go around solving problems profitably. And so for me, just that radar of what can we do and how can we overcome challenges, that's just, it's how I'm wired. It's how I see everything. And yeah, so that's where that post came from, was I was sort of in reaction to being called an optimist with a negative association and really wanting to justify why I actually think that I can pull this stuff off. And even if I can't, for me, it's just data. So I think I put it somewhere, either I win or I learn. It's a Nelson Mandela quote. I borrowed it shamelessly. And that idea that either I'm going to win, I'm going to be successful by the expectations that I placed on myself at the start of the project, right? I would love it if I published the book and we sold 10,000 copies, right? Or I won't. And it will totally bomb and nobody will buy anything and we'll get terrible reviews, right? That's what most people would decide is a failure. And they get so wrapped up in the external outcomes of, is it successful or is it a failure, that they forget that at the end of the day, even if the book completely bombs, I'm bound to learn something from that. I'm going to learn how to write better. I'm going to learn how to get a better illustrator. I'm going to learn how to do better marketing. I'm going to learn not to use that publishing company, right? I'm going to learn a lot of data that I'm going to then take into the next opportunity. And I noted that most of my epic failures, those faceplant moments that we all have in our lives, they end up being the best stories. And the stuff that I learned in those experiences has paid dividends over and over and over in my life. And so when you stop holding yourself back because you don't know what the future is going to look like, then you can really step out with confidence and say, you know what, I'm going to try this thing, feeling called to it. And if it works, fantastic. If it doesn't work, I'm going to learn a lot from this and I'm going to try again better, stronger, and more knowledgeable.
Well, buddy, you just listed all of the questions that I have in the statements. I have so many questions because that was jam-packed. That brief statement was jam-packed with just vital information that demands discussion, that cannot be just taken lightly. Now, let's begin with this, that one thing I like about an opportunist, and this may be my observation, but I would like to get your feedback on it, is that an opportunist is a very keen observationist. An opportunist is paying attention and then therefore can see an opportunity. If you're not paying attention, if you're just stuck in whatever this moment looks like at this moment, not as it could be or might be, you are stuck. That is not paying attention to the ramifications and to the opportunity. Would you agree that it has a lot to do with paying attention and seeing Absolutely. That there's something in there?
Mm-hmm. Yep. You got to have your eyes open for sure.
Very much. Now, there was a phrase in your post that I struggled with that you just gave clarity on, and I think it's important that we spend a bit of time discussing this, and that you said in your post that you advocate planning with a focus on that which you can control. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you reframed it in your discussion here as influence, because we really are not in control, are we? I mean,
right.
at the end of the day, things happen that are just out of our control that we can't expect. But you use the word influence, things that I can influence. I like to say probably one of the greatest gifts in my life, what I would call my strongest skills, is that of influencer. I'm not a decider. I don't say do this, do that. I just influence thought. I influence discussion. I influence thinking about things that you wouldn't ordinarily influence. And instead of being an advocate on that which you can control, on that which you can make an influence. Does that seem to resonate with you at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that circle of influence is a good way to think about it. I think there are things that are more or less, and even the things that you think you do control. Really, at the end of the day, the only thing that we control is our attitude. That's what I've come to realize, is the circumstances will happen, but you get to choose how you respond.
May I just interject? You know who agrees with you on that?
Hmm.
Viktor Frankl in Man's Meaning for Life.
Hmm.
And, you know, that ever so multi-million copy seller of In Search of Meaning. I think that's it.
Okay.
It's In Search of Meaning. Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust victim. And in the Holocaust, yeah. That was the one thing he said, you could not control circumstances, but you could control your perspective and your attitude and how you receive that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This influence in your businesses, you've been extraordinarily successful for such a young woman. How do you view influence and success as a businesswoman? Influence as opposed to control?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really fun one. My brain's like spinning on all these different tangents that I want to take.
Feel free.
So influence versus control. I think, to your point, recognizing that very little is under your control except your response, how you interpret the data, like what you believe about your interpretation of the data, how you decide to act in response to the data. So everything is data, right? Your brain is taking in, what is it? I think it's something crazy, like 11 billion bits of information every second, but your brain can only really handle, and it's some minuscule number.
Yeah, like two.
but it's this recognition that you're never seeing the whole picture. And so assuming that you are going to do anything resembling like the right decision or the right action is just pure ego. The best you can do is just kind of say, all right, given what I know, this is what I'm doing. What I have been testing most recently with fantastic results is surrendering everything to the divine and whatever word you choose. There's a great book called The Surrender Experiment. And even though I'm a Christian, he's not, but he still talks about the same principle that you in your finite understanding of what's happening from your very limited perspective, this sensation of control is actually what's holding you hostage. And as soon as you can release the expectation that you are in control and you can allow yourself to appreciate everything that happens as if this is the perfect unfolding of the divine plan, life just gets a lot simpler. And that stress and anxiety and overwhelm that I think our society is just addicted to, I know I personally am still kind of on like a withdrawal plan from those hormones, is just recognizing that, to your point, we're not in control. And the more we can accept that and surrender and recognize that we are an actor, we are acting, but we can be in alignment with what the universe is trying to do through us, or we can be fighting against what the universe is trying to do through us. And life just gets a lot easier when you assume that it's working for you and you interpret everything that happens with that lens. So I don't know, for, as you mentioned, like as a female in business, I don't know if this is a feminine energy or if we are all feminine in relationship to the divine masculine, right? So if we think of the divine as the initiator and we are the receivers and the responders, then I would argue that we are all feminine. And so as I've been leaning into what does feminine leadership look like, for me, it starts with the spiritual realm where I just am in a constant state of surrender. And it's been really interesting. The CEO and the COO that I mentioned hiring earlier, they were both where I just simply said, this is what I think would be best for the company. Like, I recognize I'm not going to be able to handle daily affairs. This is the kind of person that I'm looking for. And I wrote what Bob Proctor called a goal card. It says, I am so happy and grateful now that. And you write out your vision of the future as if it's happening in real and present time. And both times I got very detailed. I love getting on the phone with these people. They're so creative and fun. We just enjoy our conversations together. I trust them implicitly. They're detail focused, but they can also see the big picture. They're happy to follow through on my vision, but they're also excited to give their own suggestions for improvement. Like, I just journaled for a couple of pages. Might have taken hours, who knows. And then I feel like that was me submitting my order to God. I was like, all right, God, this is what I think would be perfect. And then sure enough, in both of their cases, I sort of turned it into a job description because I do feel like it's good to move back into the masculine and put some linear, like more left brain structure around that. And so I posted a combination of kind of my heartfelt, passionate vision as well as the more analytical structure of what I'm looking for and required and expectations. And one, just it was a personal friend. And then the other one that was ended up being perfect, and I hadn't thought about it because he had his own business. And then the other one, she was referred to me by somebody who, a friend of mine, referred my COO to me. And both people were just absolutely perfect. And I'm now living in that reality that I journaled about several months ago. And I realized, wow, the hardest part was I just got clear on what I wanted and how it would feel when this thing had been taken care of. And then it was taken care of. And it sounds so woo-woo, magical, whatever, but it keeps happening. Like,
it's not woo-woo. It's not woo-woo, magical, and whatever. It is not explained it. And it may feel that way to you, but in my reception of the of your interpretation of it, it is very practical and very down to earth. Mm-hmm. I strongly concur because I have been introduced to the divine feminine. And the feminine in my life, very, very strong, very, very strong, very right-brained, very giving, nurturing, birthing even, going through periods of gestation that are all very feminine. And that is, as I get older, my personality type, the inferior, which is the feminine in me, becomes much, much more pronounced, and it's becoming very pronounced. So I think that integration of the yin and the yang and the feminine energy and the masculine energy need to be integrated. Rilke, I just read just devouring letter to a young poet, and Rilke talks about love is a genderless thing. It is two human beings that are caring for one another with each different aspects, but there is almost not a gender involved. It's also not a male and a female. It's just two different aspects, and I like that very much. I like that feminine nature that is not as controlling as it is nurturing, but it is still with great love, great devotion, and has a time, you know, there is that feminine that's just not totally accepting, you know, their acceptance of bad doing. That feminine says, you know, like my mom, who was the perfect example, my adopted mother, you know, hey, you get this together, or you're going to die, you know, and and yet I will never stop loving you. No matter what you do, I will never stop. So love never became an issue, but that was that strong integration. There's something else that you talked about that I want to bring up as we're going on here. And I really like it. You said, and I added a phrase to it, but I know you would approve, life is a never-ending collection of data. But it's a never-ending collection of data that you must interpret and you must use. It's not just this collection of data and we get this list. There's an interpretation of that data of how that applies and to whatever you want to do next. And you seem to have the ability to recognize, collect data, and then use that data to influence and make decisions for your future.
Yeah, and I think it's this faith, whatever it is, it's a priori, right? But it's this belief, this foundational belief.
Will you explain a priori? Because most of us don't understand what that means.
Sure. Yeah, so in philosophy, there are the things that you can prove and the things that you have to start with. So Euclid, when he's doing geometry, if you're going to do a proof, you have to start with certain axiomatic principles that we can't prove that A cannot be A and not A at the same time, but we've got to use it so that we can move forward. And for me, the belief that the universe is on my side, that everything that happens is happening for me, not against me, that is just, I can't prove it, right? You could interpret all the data as it's working for you or it's working against you, getting back to that optimist versus pessimistic principle that we started with. But for me, I'm just so committed to that principle that it allows me to interpret everything, even the sucky stuff that happens, right? And I often think that we think, say it's good or it's bad, when really what we mean is comfortable or uncomfortable.
I love that phrase. But, I've got to tell you, Caitlin, I read that. I love that. It's not good or bad. That gets confused with comfortable or uncomfortable.
Yeah, looking back through my life, my husband and I, our first pregnancy was a miscarriage after 5 months, and it was devastating at the time. I was really angry with God, right? And there was so much, but it was because I was interpreting as this is bad, this is wrong, this shouldn't have happened. And I had all of these expectations of what was due me as a good person or whatever, right? There was so much of this stuff that I was interpreting. And looking back, I recognize, right, that 5 months was a gift. I was being prepared to become a mom, right? The first time it just happened so easily, I didn't appreciate it. I was flippant with it. I was like, yeah, whatever. And the second one, I just cherished. Right now, I had an appreciation for this miracle that was happening inside of me. And I wouldn't have had Cora because the timing would have been off. Like, it would have been a different egg that I got. And I'm sure I would have loved that egg just as much as I love Cora, but
it was not the egg that was given to you.
But not the egg that was given to me. And so the way I think about it is now I've got an extra daughter. I really feel like God gave me a vision of her and I got to see her and meet her, which was such a gift. But she's just on the other side. She's just hanging out and supporting us from the heavenly realms. Can you get to the point where you can just view everything as a gift? And what could that be like if you assume that even the worst things that happened, like, I know we're talking about horrible things. We're learning about genocide while we're on the road and hatred and race, like racial tensions and bigotry and rape and all of these awful things that happen. But if you can assume that everything is being worked out and it's helping us to understand, it's data. Like, oh, I really don't prefer slavery. really don't prefer bigotry, right? And it gives us this opportunity to make better decisions, to take positive actions in alignment with what we do prefer, which is love and joy and peace and harmony, right? And it inspires us to shift the world so that it does look more like what I want it to look like, so that it is better for my grandkids than it is for me, right? But without having that same anger, hatred, reaction, right? It's very difficult to create a world of love, joy, and peace from a state of anger and hatred and frustration. So I feel like we need to live in the beingness if we want to see it actualized in our circumstances.
Yeah, I'll refer to Rilke. Rilke says we need to live into the, quit trying to find answers to the questions. We need to live into the questions and let the answers emerge, but live into that question. I'm going to wrap up with a thought, and then I want your feedback on it, and we'll close. But I have a new insight, and that is the divine working in my life, and that we have from an old phrase that I use over and over and over, and I will continue to use over and over and over, that I heard 40 years ago, you are who you have been becoming. It's a magnificent phrase. I mean, it just sums up life to me. You are who you have been becoming. So there's a part of today, Caitlin, and I'll just talk about you. There's a part of today where you have certain tasks to do. There are certain obligations that you must prepare for with your family, with your business, with your thought process. And so you do those faithfully. But there's another part of today that is not the doing. There's another part of today that is in preparation for tomorrow. Every day preceding today has been in preparation of today, just as today is in preparation for tomorrow and for what comes in our life. And that is the intervention of the divine. The divine is preparing us for what the divine or the source or the universe, whatever language you care to use, that we are in a process of preparation. And what you're doing now is wonderful. And there's so much you're going to benefit, but it is going to prepare your entire family for their future. And I like that we view today not as a static, we're just doing today. Today is preparing us for tomorrow. How do you respond to that?
I think that's beautiful. Yeah, and just for the people who are listening, I just want to encourage you, you are perfect just as you are today for today. That I love that quote because it reminds us that everything has been working out for you and you are perfect just as you are. And tomorrow, you're becoming the person you need to be for tomorrow's adventures. And so, yeah, just rest in the grace of that, that things are working through you and for you.
Caitlin Kogan-Domner, my friend, I'm telling you, it's always like this, isn't it? Talking with you is such a treat.
So fun.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you so much for taking time out. Well, you had to drive to a parking lot to do this show, which is just, I feel privileged that you would do so. And let's keep in touch. And hopefully there can come a time where I can meet you in Europe or somewhere and we can spend a couple of days together and enjoy each other's company. Hi and love to your family for me, okay?
Thank you so much.
Okay, hang on for a minute, buddy, after the show. I want to thank our listeners for tuning into the next chapter with Charlie. We always enjoy having you. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.